His fellow smallholders in Thurby Village were all steady characters and did not indulge beyond a social glass of beer now and then. And his next-door neighbour had been somewhat bitter when he spoke to me a few weeks ago. "He's now but a bloody nuisance, is out, Harold."
"But how do you mean?"
"Well, every Saturday night and every market night he's up roaring and singing till 4 o'clock in the morning."
"Harold Ingledew? Surely not. He's such a quiet little chap."
"Aye, he is for rest at week.
But I can't imagine him singing."
"You should live next door to him, Mr. Harriet. He makes an hell of a racket. There's no sleep for anybody till he settles down."
Since then I had heard from another source that this was perfectly true, and that Mrs. Ingledew tolerated it because her husband was entirely submissive at all other times. The road to Thurby had a few sharp little switchbacks before it dipped to the village, and looking down I could see the long row of silent houses curving away to the base of the fell, which by day hung in peaceful green majesty over the huddle of roofs, but now bulked, black and menacing, under the moon. As I stepped from the car and hurried round to the back of the house, the wind caught at me again, jerking me to wakefulness as though somebody had thrown a bucket of water over me. But for a moment I forgot the cold in the feeling of shock as the noise struck me. Singing. Loud, raucous singing echoing around the old stones of the yard. It was coming from the lighted kitchen window.
"Just a song at twilight, when the lights are low."
I looked inside and saw little Harold sitting with his stocking feet extended towards the dying embers of the fire, while one hand clutched a bottle of brown ale.
"And the flickering shadows softly come and go."
He was really letting it rip. Head back, mouth wide. I thumped on the kitchen door.
"Though the heart be weary, sad the day and long,"
replied Harold's reedy tenor, and I banged impatiently at the woodwork again. The noise ceased, and I waited an unbelievably long time till I heard the key turning and the bolt rattling back. The little man pushed his nose out and gave me a questioning look.
"I've come to see your sheep," I said.
"Oh, aye." He nodded curtly with none of his usual diffidence.
"I'll put me boots on."
He banged the door in my face and I heard the bolt shooting home. Taken aback as I was, I realised that he wasn't being deliberately rude. Bolting the door was proof that he was doing everything mechanically. But for all that, he had left me standing in an uncharitable spot. Vets will tell you that there are corners in farmyards which are colder than any hilltop, and I was in one now. Just beyond the kitchen door was a stone archway leading to the open fields, and through this black opening there whistled a Siberian draught which cut effortlessly through my clothes. I had begun to hop from one foot to the other when the singing started again.
"There's an old mill by the stream, Nelly Dean."
Horrified, I rushed back to the window. Harold was back in his chair, pulling on a vast boot and taking his time about it. As he bellowed, he poked owlishly at the lace holes and occasionally refreshed himself from the bottle of brown ale. I tapped on the window.
"Please hurry, Mr. Ingledew. Where we used to sit and dream, Nelly Dean!"
bawled Harold in response. My teeth had begun to chatter before he got both boots on, but at last he reappeared in the doorway.
"Come on, then," I gasped. "Where is this you? Have you got her in one of these boxes?"
The old man raised his eyebrows.
"Oh, she's not here."
"Not here?"
"Nay, she's up in top buildings."
"Right back up the road, you mean?"
"Aye. I stopped off on the way home and had a look at her."
I stamped and rubbed my hands.
"Well, we'd better drive back up. But there's no water, is there? You'd better bring a bucket of warm water, some soap and a towel."
"Very good."
He nodded solemnly, and before I knew what was happening, the door was slammed shut and bolted, and I was alone again in the darkness. I trotted immediately to the window and was not surprised to see Harold seated comfortably again. He leant forward and lifted the kettle from the hearth, and for a dreadful moment I thought he was going to start heating the water on the ashes of the fire. but with a gush of relief I saw him take hold of a ladle and reach into the primitive boiler in the old black grate.
"And the waters, as they flow, seem to murmur sweet and low,"
he warbled, happy at his work, as he unhurriedly filled a bucket. I think he had forgotten I was there when he finally came out, because he looked at me blankly as he sang,
"You're my heart's desire, I love you, Nelly Dean,"
he informed me at the top of his voice. All right," I grunted, "let's go." I hurried him into the car and we set off on the way I'd come. Harold held the bucket at an angle on his lap, and as we went over the switchbacks, the water slopped gently onto my knee. The atmosphere in the car soon became so highly charged with beer fumes that I began to feel lightheaded.
"In here,"
the old man barked suddenly as a gate appeared in the headlights. I pulled onto the grass verge and stood on one leg for a few moments till I had shaken a surplus pint or two of water from my trousers. We went through the gate and I began to hurry towards the dark bulk of the hillside barn, but I noticed that Harold wasn't following me. He was walking aimlessly round the field.
"What are you doing, Mr. Ingledew?"
"Looking for you."
"You mean she's outside?"
I repressed an impulse to scream.
"Aye. She lambed this afternoon, and I thought she'd be right enough out here."
He produced a torch, a typical farmer's torch, tiny and with a moribund battery, and projected a fitful beam into the darkness. It made not the slightest difference.